Hello and welcome to another episode of The Blind Side on the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined not only by Sam Lana again, who continues with me on this crusade, but especially delighted to be joined by Tom Tainton from Bristol Bears Rugby Club. Tom, thank you very much for being here. You look well. Dare I say, have you summered well? Is summer a period where you can kind of switch off?
Gentlemen, great to be here. Thank you for having me on. Do you know what? We've had a really good summer. Obviously, from a Bears perspective, we had a good bit of momentum going into the end of the season. Everyone's got away and had a good break. I was actually over in Cape Town for the Junior World Cup, which was excellent. And exciting to see some real talent coming through there. And then now back in the mix and a couple of weeks to go before it all kicks off again. So all is well down in Bear Country, but I'm sure if you asked every club during pre-season, they'd say the same thing.
Oh, absolutely, indeed. I mean, we could have you on to talk about a range of different things. And every time I talk to you, Tom, I always come away going, oh, I wish I'd asked him this. I wish I'd spoken to him about that. I'm going to try and keep it, if I can, to one particular element, because I will not be alone. I know Sam is very much of the opinion that we are fans of Bristol Bears on social media. I mean, okay, we might not be fans of Bristol Bears on rugby, but whenever you post on social media, it's always worth a gander. I mean, you guys have seemed to embrace the digital age that rugby sits in so well. Can you talk about the evolution of your social media presence? I mean, was it always something that you earmarked early on to get involved with?
Well, firstly, I think it's fitting that the three of us are having this conversation, because I would say that both of you have carved out your own digital presence in a unique way. And I think that's really important for our sport, because we all want the same thing, right? We want to open it up to new audiences. We want different perspectives. And I think the work that you guys have done on your own channels is a really positive thing, as is this podcast. For us as a club, let's be frank, at the time when we rebranded to Bristol Bears, and that was the catalyst for a lot of this sort of pivot in our tone and our language, we had historically not been a particularly successful club. Like the 10 years prior to the rebrand, as Sam will know well from our many trips to Goldington Road, it was a well-assembled team that couldn't quite get through the playoffs. We were up, we were down. We had a dwindling supporter base. And we needed to re-engage, and we needed to start a new journey. And us going through that commercial rebrand also gave us an opportunity to scrutinize all areas of our business, whether it was customer facing, whether it was what we did from an internal culture standpoint. And one of those key metrics for us was, well, how do we talk to fans? What language do we use? What's our tone? What do we stand for? And I remember that first summer post rebrand, so it would have been the summer of 2018, and the way that we approached things on social media, like, it was quite different, and a lot of people were like, oh, I'm not sure if this is good, bad, but I kind of want to keep watching, because something could happen here. And I think actually what we've seen now, obviously to our social media team here, I think the biggest compliment to those guys is that what Bristol Bears were doing in 2018, all the clubs are now doing. So you've actually seen, you know, like a rising tide lifts all boats, right? Like, I think that what we're seeing now is some really slick collaborations, some really effective marketing between teams. I think that Saracens and Harlequins in particular do things really well in that sense. And I've got to pay credit to the guys at Premiership Rugby, Rob and Souk, in that marketing team, because they are trying, and they are aware that all of us are accountable for raising the marketing value of the competition. And look, we're in a new world, right, of instant gratification and social media, and an audience that wants answers and fun at their fingertips. You've got to capture the imagination early, and social media is such a unique and valuable platform to be able to do that. I think clubs have probably been a bit slow, us included, to understanding the true commercial value of the digital age and where it lies. But certainly from our perspective, and what we've been able to do with through social media and how we've been able to talk to different audiences. And as you said there, Sam, almost create a bit of a pseudo digital fan that isn't necessarily coming to Ashton Gate every week. Like, it does have a tangible impact on your commercial revenue, on your numbers through the door. We're continuing to buck the trend. Our attendances are going up. They're getting younger. There's more females. There's more under 12s. So there are positive signs from being really consistent and also like just being a bit brave. You're not going to get everything right. And there are some things that are going to make other people wince. But the point is that you want a brand that people can align to and people will find funny, but also holds the same values and is inclusive. And I think what I probably learned early doors and where sport has probably been perhaps slightly slower to understand is that the social media is not necessarily the reflection of the club, in the sense that like Pat Lam isn't sat there saying, right, this is our chance to have a jibe at the opposition. Pat Lam is on the pitch focusing on getting the team prepared. The role of the social media team is to create narrative, engage discussion, look at how we can find little stories and intricacies throughout the week. And ultimately all we want is eyeballs and we want conversations. And that's, you know, that's what all of us are here in that media space for rugby want to achieve.
Do you, this is a question that I'm wrestling with, as you say, do you see a different need to be a different person on different platforms? And not a different person, a different message on different platforms. So something you put on Facebook isn't going to run as well as something on Twitter, on TikTok, on Snapchat, or wherever it is, because you've got completely different audiences. And are you starting to think about what you put on different channels? Because they completely and utterly speak. And I give you an example. This amazing thing that was going around Twitter about advice for A-level graduates on Twitter. And everyone was going, there's no A-level graduates on Twitter. Why are you talking to them? They're not here. They're all on TikTok. You know, so do you think about that? How is that now manifesting itself within your team?
It's a great question and it's really prevalent. So we would have a separate linear strategy against every single one of those platforms that we use. So you're absolutely right that the way that we talk on LinkedIn is going to be completely different to Twitter and so on and so forth. What we found now is our fastest growing platform is Instagram. Mm-hmm. And has been for the last 3 or 4 years. We get great engagement on TikTok, but in a very different way. That demographic audience of 15 to 21 year olds, they're not that tribal. They don't really care if it's Bristol Bears or someone else, but what they want to see is they want to see things that are dynamic and interesting and behind the scenes. And I think probably we've also noticed that the reaction and the temperature of our fan base is very different depending on what channels. So we know that if we were talking to our supporters on, say, Facebook, for example, then we need to be really clear with our comms that there needs to be a lot of detail. We can expect that there's going to be some questions that we need to be really reactive and ready to go with. We have the Facebook audience would typically be older. There would be a longer dwell time and therefore they'd want to consider things and they'd have different questions. With Instagram, it's almost universally positive all the time. Because a lot of it is just the boys sharing stuff and young people and everyone sort of chucking hands and hearts. And so we find that Instagram can be far more of like a snapshot. It's a guy in training. It's someone in the gym. It's someone arriving to work and look what cool clothes they're wearing. And actually, you're probably not getting a huge amount of like chunky detail and information. Whereas Facebook might sit as a completely different method. And obviously, look, I personally, obviously, it's a testament to how old I'm getting, guys, but I still see a value in Twitter or X in terms of that like instant update of live news. Like certainly during the season, it's much easier for me to load up Twitter and have a scroll through and understand where games are going along and what the perception are and where challenges have been during the fixtures, as opposed to going on the BBC app, for example, and just seeing the scoreline. So I guess the challenge that we have now internally is there's so many different options. how do you decide and define which ones you want to push your resource to? Because obviously we're all cognizant of the fact that we don't have huge social media teams. We have to be really strategic about where we put our time. And obviously it's very different to where it was 10 years ago. And if we were having this conversation in 5 years' time again, I'm sure we'd be talking about it in a very different way again.
Tom, just from my perspective, obviously within the kind of post-Drive to Survive world, where if you're the fan of a sport, you don't just expect to watch a sport, you expect to see backroom conversations which you'd never ever have seen, you know, maybe 5 years ago. And there's an element of that with the BBC kind of behind the scenes training. We see sometimes a little bit more than that. Do you think you're involved in a bit of an arms race to show more than more of what's going on? And is this ever a conflict with coaches where obviously they want to keep a little bit of that hidden, but for you it would be beneficial to put as much as possible out there?
Yeah, 100%, Sam. And I think that the American franchises and the American competitions have really set the bar there. Culturally, of course, it's a completely different beast. But if we think about Hard Knocks, if we think about All or Nothing, mm-hmm. and the access that they're getting and the real characters they're showing, I do still think that rugby and English sport has some way to go there. Like, it does still feel like a little bit of a sanitized product when we see behind the scenes content. And you're absolutely right. You're wrestling against a number of needs internally, the requirements from the coaches, the requirements from the players, obviously GDPR around injuries and what we can and can't show. That it's a little bit of a minefield. But I think what we have to do better as a sport is step out of what we need in our tiny little bubble and think about what the audience wants and become an audience first competition. Because the young guy or girl on the street, like, they want to be served content that is unique, that is authentic. Like, I'm not a huge fan personally of Formula One, but I loved Drive to Survive.
Yeah.
It was about characters. They created narratives. And I think that we need to be better at telling those stories about some of the players that we have. And it doesn't always have to be this kind of perfect, rosy, traditional values of rugby. Actually, like, rugby is confrontational and it's high performance and it's tense and there's arguments and conflict and disputes. And that's like, that's sport. That's the reality of sport. That's why we love it. And that's what people want to see. And but I think we're all responsible there, because, you know, I'm not saying this is the case, but if there is a sense of guardedness, or if there is a sense of paranoia perhaps on the club side, well, that has to have stemmed from somewhere. So the media also have a responsibility of working with the clubs so that when they do have access, this isn't their, right, I'm rubbing my hands together, this is my chance, huge headline, or this is my way to get it over. Like, we have to all be sort of pulling in the same direction, if that makes sense.
Can you mentioned something there. It's a really small nugget. You talked about GDPR around injuries. Many fans will say, why can't we know? Why don't we know about what's happening with this player? Can you explain the complexities therein?
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, every individual has a right to confidentiality around their medical needs and requirements. But obviously, we also have an obligation to our fan base and those stakeholders. So I think there probably is a middle ground. Sam, what I mean by GDPR is, let's take a hypothetical example. Like, if a player was having quite a serious surgery on his back, it might not be in the player's interests for mm-hmm. people to know that he had a back for future contracts and so on and so forth. So there's a commercial consideration, but also the player might not feel comfortable with people knowing, because he might have something else in his life. And we obviously should want to and would respect that. By the same token, what you don't want is this sort of black hole of fans not feeling like they are getting any tangible information out of the club. And actually, the only time the club wants to talk to the fans is to say, buy a ticket, buy a shirt. Like, you need to break away from that transient relationship where you're actually, you know, you are showing the fan base and that audience and media respect as well, of saying, well, look, this guy is unavailable, and he's unavailable in very broad terms because of leg or mm-hmm. whatever, and we expect him to be out for 3 to 4 weeks. It's not a perfect answer, I appreciate, because every coach and every club will do it differently.
Yeah.
And every head of medical will have a different feeling as to how those messages should be framed. But I think ultimately it feeds back into that point of the fan base, our customer base, have a right to understand and know where their product is on a week to week basis. So, and we have an obligation to service that.
Yeah, a great answer. And again, a fascinating thing for fans to try and understand. Where do ideas come from? And this is a question that I want you to sort of reveal about how your team works, I suppose. Where do ideas come from? And the juiciest part of this question is, have you ever got it wrong?
So where do ideas come from? I think that there's originality now is pretty rare, right? So we will constantly be looking at what other clubs in other sports are doing, scouring other teams' channels, looking at different memes, understanding what's topical at the time. We're served so much depth of information on a day-to-day basis, and there's always lots of nice little touch points that you can develop as your own. And the other point on there, Sam, is that once you've set a perception of who you are, and I use Bears as an example here, people are far more open to seeing it. Yeah. So if it was a club that was far more traditional in the way that they positioned their brand, and suddenly they came out today with a Hollywood film meme, and they've put their coach's head on someone in Gladiator, you'd be like, okay, I mean, it's fun, but it's also really weird and out of kilter. Like, if Bears did it, you'd be like, well, I'm just carrying on scrolling because that's just going to go.
That's natural.
And in terms of, look, we've made a ton of mistakes, and it depends on how you define mistakes, because mistakes might be that it just hasn't had cut through. Mistakes might be that we've misjudged the tone. I think that the most effective, to turn that question into a positive, the most effective content we've done is when it's been effectively planned and communicated. So, for example, when we signed Max Malins, obviously, you know, he came on a loan for a year, and then
I remember the thing that you did with Saracens and all of that. It was brilliant. Yes. Absolutely fantastic.
And obviously, on the face of it, if you're watching, the whole idea is you're thinking, phew, that's a bit close to the bone. Like, how are Saracens going to feel about it? And then Saracens come back and they're sort of having a pop at us. And you're thinking, okay, this isn't – the whole point is the whole thing was manufactured behind of the course. Scenes. Everyone was aligned. And that's really positive. And you see that almost on a week-to-week basis in the NBA and the NFL.
But come on, how did you do that? Who picked up the phone first? You, Saracens? How did it work? Can you remember?
I think because we were signing Max, I think that we would have reached out to Saracens, but Saris are very, very open to, I mean, even this year with the fixture launch where we, pixelated out the Saracens food, like Saracens are very open to having some fun. And I think they understand as well the power of having two combined platforms, and driving that engagement. So, but we're trying to do the same with clubs across the league. Obviously, we've got our first marquee game at the Principality next May. There's a real opportunity there for us to work closely with Bath and have some real fun online there. Like, ultimately, I want the guys to come in and feel like, yes, we work for a rugby club, but I want the mentality to be, well, you work for a marketing company that has a rugby club. Because the whole idea is we want people to get interested in rugby. We want cut through. We want a bigger audience, because what comes with audience and what comes with engagement, as we all know, is sustainability, is increased values in the game that we all care about.
I couldn't put it better myself. Sam, have you got a question?
Yeah. So one of the things I'm interested in is, obviously, with all online, we're probably online a little bit too much, the three of us, but one of the things that, as soon as a post gets beyond a certain point, that's when at least some negativity starts kicking in, and you get people moaning about whatever it is that you've posted. Now, I guess this is particularly problematic for clubs, because you want people and audiences want people to be authentic, and they want players to be authentic, and you want to hear what they have to say. But as soon as they say something even remotely controversial or that might be taken controversially, they get jumped on for that. Is that ever the thing that you, I guess, worry about and try and steer away from? Or do you just accept that the vast majority of people will enjoy that engagement and enjoy hearing about those players and they will largely ignore, or you can largely ignore the negativity that might come with that?
It's an interesting one, Sam, because from my perspective, I don't mind negative comments because I think negative comments creates conversation. I think if someone is responding and we have been offensive or we've been discriminatory, or which obviously we never would, but if we were, then they would have a right to voice that opinion and it would be completely unacceptable from our side. But if we're saying, oh, you know, we're doing this or this player's here, and someone comes back and says, you know, I hate it and you guys are all idiots. Well, that's their right to say that. But my view is it's also our right to then go back and say and have a bit of a back and forth. And I'm not saying you want to go into the sort of death spiral of internet trolling. But one thing that we really sort of hung our hat on back in 2018 and it's carried through is like we have to be really resilient on social media, online, across all of our digital, because if we back what we're saying and we believe it and we know that it's right and it's right for us and it's right for the game, it doesn't really make a difference to me if people like it or not. That's their right to like it. But as long as those people are conversing in a way that is respectful, then I'm all for it.
Yeah. Are you seeing a trend towards more positivity? Because Bristol, you know, as we say at the start, you're not my club, but you would definitely be there in the second or third positioning as a kind of my favourite kind of neutral club, I guess, because you come across on social media as such a friendly kind of, you know, inclusive club. Do you feel that over time that consistent messaging has led to less negativity and more positivity, or is it just a kind of social media phenomenon that you can do whatever you want, you can save as many puppies as you want, but there's always going to be someone who's going to be negative about it?
I think if this is something that that we as a club have done really effectively, I think because we've set a very clear vision for what we want to achieve and we've communicated that relentlessly to our fan base, I think that a lot of times now what I'm seeing, and it's really fulfilling from our side, is that if we come up with something and there is a group of fans that want to pick holes in it, we often find that there'll be another group of fans that almost defend it on our part. So actually we find that sort of that kind of peer group sort of theory that supports that argument. But that only comes from us being able to say right at the start, like, look, we're not going to get everything right. We're certainly not going to win every week, and you know, as no club is able to. But we really care about our community. We really want to be inclusive, and we want to support. And we're proud of our women's team and LGBTQ opportunities, and all of that. We are going to be seen as the most progressive club, and we want to be the most fun club, and we want people to come to Ashton Gate and have this unbelievable match day experience. So if I want people, when they're talking about Bears, if they're saying, well, actually, you know, they're a bit rubbish, or they're a bit inconsistent, or whatever they're going to say, but off field, they're really switched on and they're doing things that are good for the sport. And when the fans believe in that self-fulfilling prophecy as well, then it just helps that narrative grow and grow online.
I've got a question from a fan, Tom. It says that Mr. A. Smith from Clifton, he says, have you got any bobble hats? explain that comment, because that's an inside joke, so you explain it.
So the 2019-20 season, I mean, it's so niche. season, we had a delayed shipment of bobble hats for the Christmas retail drive, so a lot of fans were very unhappy that they couldn't buy their bobble hats, and we were sort of getting peppered for a good few weeks. And I think we had a tweet that went viral because I think we were away at Saracens at the Stonex and we were about 40 points down, and someone tweeted, when can I buy my bobble hat? And I think the token said, not now, Anne, we're kind of busy. And it sort of erupted from there. So the fact that it's still it's still a point of contention in 2024 is something else.
Well, only for me, Sam, only for me. And I knew you'd like that. What's the one thing that you wish fans, connected to this, I suppose, what's the one thing you wish fans knew about your job? What's the common misconception about what you do?
What a great question. I think that perhaps the common misconception is from fans is that we aren't spending every day here trying to deliver something that they want. So I think that, you know, every decision that we make and where we have to balance against the commercial needs of the business, against fan engagement, whether that's setting our season ticket pricing, match day strategy, taking games away from Ashton Gate, which players we re-sign, who we recruit, like all of that comes with the supporter in mind, because it's such a cliche to say, but it's true. Like, supporters are the lifeblood of every club. None of it, we wouldn't have a league and we wouldn't have clubs if we didn't have a supporter base. So I think that as clubs modernize, as the business models of sport grow, there probably is a minority of fans that feel that their club is becoming more detached from their values, and it's a faceless corporation and they're just here to fleece us and all of this stuff. And that's absolutely not the case. Like, that's actually, you know, I wake up every morning and, you know, when I look at my to-do list, like, so many of those items are about, well, how can we make the experience better for our fans and for Bristolians, and how can we leave a positive legacy? So I guess that would be the one. And I get it, because I'm obviously a fan of myself of other sports and other clubs, and it's natural because you care deeply and you want your club to be successful. But of course, it is a business, and it's challenging and it's hard, and especially hard at the moment with the current commercial and financial situation that we find ourselves with Prem Rugby and Rugby Union in the UK. You have to balance really tough decisions against the needs and wants of your fan base. And I should just add there, like, I'm really bullish on rugby, and I'm really bullish on where the sport can go. I think we all have to acknowledge that it's been a really challenging 18 months and what's happened and losing the clubs, et cetera, and where we've been in the post-COVID landscape. But I feel really positive about what we're doing, what the plans are behind the scenes. I think the product on the field is the best it's ever been. I think there are a lot of really exciting young homegrown players coming through for all the teams. For us now, it's about how do we package that up. And how do we sell that? And when I say sell, I mean in the sense of, like, how do we engage and get people excited about what we all care about and are passionate about week to week?
Mm. One of the things I find really fascinating there, Tom, is I completely share your positivity there. I think it's refreshing as well to hear someone say it, because, you know, we can get caught in that spiral of just doing the be down and then wondering why it's worse than it was, seems to be worse than it was. But one of the things, I remember probably a year or so ago asking my girlfriend to name five rugby players, and I think she got to three, and one of them was Lawrence Dallaglio. And there does seem to be a lack of characters, which I think may sound like a negative, but actually it potentially gives guys like you, and obviously in similar positions in similar clubs, an opportunity to grow your own characters. Because really, if we look outside the bubble, there's not too many, maybe Marcus Smith gets through, but there's not too, and DuPont, of course, and Mayer in the women's game, but there's not too many people maybe who get through. So you do have the potential to raise the profiles, and if anything, that's perhaps the biggest opportunity there.
And that's it, right? Like, it has to be seen as an opportunity. And that's also a very American mindset of having the athlete first. Like, when you think of, let's talk in, real superstar terms, but you think of someone like a LeBron James or a Kevin Durant in the NBA, like, people are fans of LeBron James, not of the Lakers. So if LeBron goes to Cleveland, they follow Cleveland. We have an opportunity with our players. And when you think of, we have a really intelligent, socially aware group of young men and women across Premiership Rugby and the PWR. But we have to break free of the shackles of this sort of faux traditionalism of rugby. And it's a controversial thing to say. And I did an interview in The Telegraph a couple of years ago where the headline was, why don't we boo kicks? And there were lots of people on the comments like, this guy's a moron, what's he talking about? But I stand by that point of like, you know, this you absolutely, the values of collaboration and humility, etc., they can still stand true, but you can still treat your players as assets, and we can grow high profile assets, and we can create stories around players. You know, we've got, I take Ellis Genge as a great example. Ellis is Bristolian. He grew up in the south of Bristol in a part of town that there is very little cut through in terms of rugby. You know, he's played for England. We're hopeful that he'll go on the Lions tour. Like, he is someone that we can be really proud of. He is an amazing story for Bristol, but we need to be so much better as a club at getting, not just getting Ellis in front of these opportunities, but also educating Ellis and other players about why it's important, why there's a benefit for them, why there's a benefit for the sport. I think it's a more rounded conversation of, do we need to do it? Yes. Where does the accountability lie? Well, it lies just as much with the players as it does with the club, as it does with the media. And I think that probably we've all perhaps pulled in different directions in the past, whereas actually all of those stakeholders want exactly the same thing. And we can tell stories about players, and we can amplify them in a way that is positive and engaging, and also opens up new opportunities for these individuals as well.
It's exciting, isn't it, Sam?
Well, I was going to say, it's so good. I've got about another 20 questions that I could ask Tom Tayton. We're going to have him back on, I think. We're going to have to see how he goes. Indeed, have him back on. It's been an absolute delight to speak to you, Tom. Thank you so much for sharing just a little bit of your world. Good luck to Bristol this year in all that it does. And keep on amusing us, if you don't mind. Is that all right?
Guys, thank you so much for your time. And great luck with the podcast. And I look forward to listening in future.